Yeah, my favorite is Monopoly. Monopoly is a great, great board game.
Don't tell that to any serious gamers. They're like, it's all luck. It's based on the roll of the die. There's no skill.
Oh no, there's definitely skill in it. Definitely.
Welcome to PitchBook's Invisible Capital Podcast, where we use data, research, and conversation to reveal important trends and issues in the private markets.
Welcome, everyone, to the Invisible Capital Podcast. We're devoting Season 1 to examining the private markets by discussing the work of PitchBook analysts and writers during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Hillary Wick, a senior analyst from PitchBook's Institutional Research Group. For this episode, we have Dominic Mondesir, an analyst from our London team, to talk about how the European markets are adjusting to the new reality. Thanks for joining us, Dom.
Thanks for having me, Hillary.
Absolutely. Before we dive into the current state of European private equity, can you share with us your background and focus here at PitchBook?
So I went to Loughborough University here in the UK. I studied economics with politics there. After my time at Loughborough, I actually went to the US. I went to Florida. I studied an MBA in finance on a full soccer scholarship. Then after I graduated with
and
my MBA.
And you actually called it soccer?
Yeah, I've definitely been converted after living there for 4.5 years. So after that, after my time there, I worked for a boutique investment bank in Florida for a number of years, kind of helping private equity firms raise capital and doing a little bit of kind of debt and equity advisory work. Then after my time there, I joined PitchBook in April 2019 as an EMEA private capital analyst, with a focus on private equity research across the EMEA region. I've been at PitchBook just under 18 months now, and it's been a great experience.
Awesome. I love how these conversations allow me to get to know my colleagues a little better. I didn't know all that. And just a point of clarification to stay away from the acronyms EMEA for those in America that are a little too isolated, what stands for what?
Oh, so Europe, Middle East, and Africa.
So for context, can you spend a bit of time describing the European PE landscape? What tends to dominate? Pan-European funds, global funds, country funds, sectors? Is there anything that you notice that is unique about the European landscape versus maybe what a lot of our listeners are used to?
Across Europe, there's definitely, you know, pan-European funds, there are global funds and country funds. We do see funds, you know, dedicated to the UK. We do see funds, you know, dedicated to like the Dutch region or the Nordics or the French and Benelux regions. But I would say the most popular funds in the European space is definitely the pan-European funds, as sponsors are able to really benefit from the diversification benefits of investing across, you know, the different European countries. And, you know, they avoid, you know, idiosyncratic kind of country risks, such as, you know, Brexit that's going on now in the UK. And obviously, if you are in the European Union, pretty much we all speak English across the European space, and we have similar laws if you're part of the EU bloc. And that kind of makes it easier for us to develop, or sponsors to develop, kind of a deeper understanding of how the pan-European markets work out. And then you also have, well, within the European place, you know, there are definitely similar kind of tail and headwinds between countries. So if you look at like growth rates, you know, across like UK, Germany, France, they're not too dissimilar. And also kind of the data does show that, you know, pan-European funds do tend to produce higher risk adjusted returns than country focused funds. However, if you do have a wide network within a particular country with deep sector expertise and, you know, a strategy that's likely to be fruitful in a particular country, then also country funds can be favorable in the European space.
Do you see a lot of, I guess, the sponsor-to-sponsor transactions, like a firm will start in the private equity sphere in the country funds and then roll up into a pan-European fund and eventually get bought by a global fund? Or, you know, would you say that, I feel like a lot of the European space would be about growing out to other countries, but that could be a total misperception of mine.
Yeah, no, definitely. So, you know, typically in the European space, we see a lot of domestic champions and not kind of pan-European champions. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of sponsors are trying to really drive value, where, you know, if you have a company in the UK that kind of dominates the market, you know, can that company go and take its services, go and take its kind of unique selling point, and can it be the dominant player in the German market or French market? So I think within Europe, we see, as I said, a lot of domestic champions, and you know, sponsors are definitely trying to drive more pan-European champions and then, you know, global champions. I think in the US, obviously, we see a lot of large multinational corporations that are really global champions in their specific sectors or fields.
Given that you study economics and politics, I have a feeling you've probably been watching Brexit. What is that going to mean for private equity? You know, you talk about English being the language, you know, pan-European, especially the language of finance. You know, what are you seeing, hearing, believing is going to happen to the private equity landscape in Europe with the Brits kind of backing out of that commitment that they used to have?
Yeah, so that's definitely a good question, and kind of only time will tell and how that's going to play out in the private markets. So since we kind of left the block on the 31st of January 2020, there's been no kind of material developments in either a trade deal or, you know, us leaving without a deal. The Brexit deadline, or the end of the transitionary period, is December 31st, and that's fast approaching. And it appears we are no closer to a trade deal. The Conservative government have emphasized on multiple occasions there will be no extension to this transition period. So essentially they're saying come December 31st, 2020, the UK is leaving the European Union with or without a deal. Now, what does this mean for private equity? I think the fundraising process is definitely going to be instantly impacted off the bat. You know, investor relations teams based in the UK who don't have a presence in other European countries, they very much rely on the AIFMD kind of marketing passport to market their UK-based funds to EU LPs. So if the UK leave the European Union without a trade deal, this passport is going to be taken away from UK-based private equity funds, which means that they cannot market their funds to EU LPs. So, you know, the marketing, compliance, portfolio and risk management of UK-based funds without a European presence is likely to become a lot more complex, expensive and time-consuming. And I actually wrote an analyst note on this in Q4 of 2019, just before the December election. So if you want to understand, you know, the deeper nuances of you know, the potential ramifications of Brexit, I'll take a look at that note. And then, yeah, there could be also short-term blackout periods, as I said, for IR teams and placement agents in raising capital. So in my opinion, I think that there definitely needs to be an appropriate extension to this transitionary period, because I don't think it's really possible for the UK and EU to strike a deal before December 2020. I don't think, you know, regulators, investors, LPs, GPs, I don't think that's going to give them adequate time to sufficiently adapt to kind of the new legal and regulatory landscape that's going to happen. So kind of your guess is as good as mine.
Well, and that said, I think the world of finance, investment banking, and even private equity has found its way to be pretty adaptable over the years and figure out ways to make money. My team's working on a paper coming out shortly on the Volcker rule changes, which are similar to your Basel Accords. And, you know, in looking through all the data, it appears that some of the investment banks never really missed a step. Others gave up some operations or sold off some private equity, and others just kept going and assumed that it would work its way out, or that their teams of lawyers and lobbyists would be able to figure out another way to do it.
Sure, yeah. If there's an equivalence regime that's given to the UK, that will definitely, you know, help to kind of minimize industry disruption. But right now, the industry have been given a lack of guidance from the government. Obviously, they've been dealing with the pandemic and COVID-19. So kind of Brexit's kind of been in the shadow, but it's now coming back to the forefront because December is fast approaching.
So getting back to the report we were here to discuss today, the European PE breakdown, it's a quarterly report, so it can become somewhat routine. But this was the first full quarter that the world spent in lockdown. At a high level, what kinds of things is our data telling us so far about these times?
So our European private equity breakdown is split up typically into three sections. So we have a deal section, an exit section, and a fundraising section. And we delve into, you know, different sectors across the European space, whether that's, you know, energy, financial services, B2B, B2C, tech, healthcare, etc. you know, different types of deals and different sizes of deals. So just to provide a little bit of context, coming into the crisis, you know, the European fundraising space hit a peak in 2019. And in Q1 of this year, you know, European private equity deal value actually hit a new quarterly peak. So, you know, the market was very much buoyant. It was at, you know, all-time highs within Europe. I would say the exit environment, that's been waning, and that's been on a downward trend in 2019 and kind of moving into Q1. However, you know, the first full quarter of lockdown, you know, the fundraising and the deal environment were completely flipped on its head, and kind of deals kind of fell off a cliff. You know, fund count and capital raised came in extremely subdued. And the downward trend in the exit market really, really accelerated during Q2.
See, that's interesting, because in the US, we saw fundraising hold up, honestly, in both private equity and venture capital. But the trend was really to the ginormous funds. There was a significant drop in number of funds closed in the first half of this year, but the actual dollars were actually flat to up, which was entirely unexpected, I would say. I mean, the trend to larger funds has been going on for a long time, but the fact that they managed to garner so many billions of dollars was pretty surprising. Did you see any sort of corollary to that in the European space?
Yeah, so I would definitely agree with that. And I would say that the bifurcation in the fundraising market has been accelerated. There, as you said, there was a trend towards investing with those experienced, well-resourced, those managers that could point to a palpable track record pre-pandemic. And I think that's only been accelerated by probably 3 to 5 years because of the pandemic. So in the European space, we did see fund count is on pace to come in at a new annual nadir. And as a capital raise came in extremely subdued. However, we do expect that capital raise number to significantly increase by the end of the year. And that's because there are a number of open mega funds in the market in the European space. We have BC Partners, Apex, EQT, they're all in the market with mega funds, and they're expected to hit their hard cap by the end of the year. And we also recently saw CVC Capital Partners. They closed on the largest ever European buyout fund. I think it was 21 billion euros, and that's going to show up in the Q3 data. So as you said, we do expect that capital raise figure to significantly increase from the first half, but fund count, I do expect that to remain low, as the pandemic has disproportionately affected, you know, those first-time funds, those spin-out funds, and those GPs without a track record to kind of point to.
Yeah, we've seen the same on the smaller end here. So many of our listeners may be more familiar with the U.S. reaction to the pandemic. What can you tell us about how different countries have handled the crisis, or different regions, and what that's meant for the private market fundraising and deals? We know, for example, that Sweden took a much different approach than most of the developed world. Italy and Spain suffered early in the crisis. Did that sort of show up in deal activity or any other sort of private equity stats, the different sort of regional differences?
So unfortunately, no European region escaped the downturn in private equity deal activity during Q2. What the data kind of showed in the second quarter was that every European region saw year-over-year declines in private equity deal volume, and the UK and Ireland actually attributed the largest drop out of all the European regions that we cover. So that wasn't too surprising, if I'm being honest, given the fact that the UK and Ireland region, it had the worst COVID-19 death rate out of any European country, and I believe it's the second worst globally, after the US. And then, you know, second,
not happy to be winning that one.
Absolutely not. Yeah. And then second, the lockdown in the UK and Ireland, it lasted pretty much throughout the bulk of Q2. So we were very late to go on lockdown, whereas our other European counterparts went on lockdown, I'd probably say near the end of Q1. And then third, we also have the backdrop of no deal Brexit, which we discussed earlier. And we are seeing, you know, the resurgence of the virus in the UK, as seen from recent localized lockdowns in areas such as Leicester, Greater Manchester. And I believe this is deterring deal makers from, you know, executing on transactions in the region. That being said, deals will still close in the UK and Ireland, as it's the largest private equity market within Europe. But there were drops across the board in Europe in terms of PE deal volume.
So what sort of deals are getting done? Are there sectors or types of deals that have found more success than others?
Yeah, so I would say, I call it kind of the phase one of the crisis. We definitely saw large but swift opportunities in kind of discounted public equities and credit. And then kind of phase two, you know, I see sponsors really providing kind of liquidity to SMEs via rescue and bridge capital. I really think, you know, there are many highly levered private companies out there that don't have access to the unprecedented fiscal and monetary support we've seen from, you know, European governments and the ECB and Bank of England. Obviously, banks are retrenching their lending facilities. Therefore, these SMEs will need some sort of capital. And I believe kind of the European private credit space and sponsors are really going to step in to help these guys bridge this gap. And then, you know, also we've seen the real acceleration in bolt-ons investments. So what we saw is that, you know, during, you know, kind of Q2, and I expect this to continue throughout the rest of the year, kind of managers really focused on increasing platform resilience, agility and stability during the crisis while playing offense via bolt-ons. They did this obviously heightening their geographic, product, customer and kind of supplier diversification. They're looking to be kind of consolidators within sectors via weaker competitors that likely have no institutional backing. You know, if companies who have institutional backing are likely, you know, to be able to ride out the crisis because of the sheer liquidity power the institution behind them has. And then also, even though carve-outs, the data in the first half, it came in extremely subdued, I do expect, you know, public and private carve-outs to considerably pick up in the second half and moving into 2021. You know, I see, as you know, the government fiscal support winds down, and as we see, you know, monetary support winding down, and as we see kind of more localized lockdowns occur and, you know, the inevitable second wave of the virus hit in autumns, I see many companies, they're going to be forced to kind of raise cash and deleverage. So that's why I kind of think, you know, carve-outs, we could be seeing more of those also.
Carve-outs being companies selling off business lines, essentially.
Exactly. So, you know, companies will have, you know, subsidiaries. Some subsidiaries will be performing better than others. And typically, I believe, you know, companies are really going to focus on their outperforming units and divest of the performance that are not performing so well.
Gotcha. Do you have a sense for how European GPs are finding balance in supporting their pre-crisis portfolios versus seeking out new investments?
Fantastic question. So I think GPs
you've touched on this a little bit, but, you know, you got to think that some of them are retrenching and trying to make sure their existing portfolio gets through this okay versus finding new deals.
Yes, absolutely. So I think during this crisis, we've seen GPs have been very defensive and offensive. And I think that's been a big difference from the GFC. I think, you know, GPs have increasingly kind of leaned into the markets while playing defense and really concentrating on their portfolio companies, on portfolio triage, you know, splitting portfolio companies up into kind of a traffic light system of red, amber and green, and understanding the effects of the pandemic on each portfolio company. I think there's been a laser focus on kind of liquidity and cash management of portfolio companies during the crisis. And then also, you know, playing offense via bolt-ons to kind of stabilize these portfolio companies or even grow their market share. Because, you know, this pandemic has really affected portfolio companies in varying different ways. You know, some have actually benefited from it. The majority have probably been adversely affected. And then I also think, you know, we're seeing GPs being laser focused on, you know, the flexibility on costs, secular demand changes, you know, balance sheet strength and kind of margin protection, and understanding kind of where the profit pools are shifting. So, you know, how are customer behavior and preferences changing in light of the pandemic? You know, let's look at our supply chain. Does that need more resilience? Do we need to bring that closer to home? You know, looking at employee kind of safety protocols. So I kind of think those are kind of some of the ways we GPs have found balance and kind of being offensive and, you know, seeking out, you know, inorganic growth via M&A, but at the same time being defensive and, you know, looking at kind of cash management, liquidity, supply chain issues within portfolio companies.
So you talked a little bit about how the last crisis looks versus this crisis. I'm curious if there's anything really noticeably different in the deal-making environment. I kind of go back to that I mentioned earlier about the Volcker Rule. What in the environment maybe is different that is allowing PE firms to act differently and hopefully in a better way to cause these companies to do better through this crisis than they might have the last time?
Sure. I think a big difference between the GFC and kind of the COVID-19 or great lockdown crisis is the unprecedented fiscal and monetary support we've seen from global central banks and global governments. And, you know, I think it's been the right thing to do. And I think that in large part has given confidence to the public and private markets to continue to lean in and play offense. And, you know, I think a lesson sponsors have learned is not waiting to understand the full impact of the current crisis to resume investment activity. I think we've seen in the European space and also in the US, you know, sponsors have been willing to write big checks during the downturn as a result of record dry powder levels in the European space and the US, and also having strong conviction in their investment strategies. And I suppose that comes from having experience of going through multiple business cycles and understanding, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. We are going to get through this. We just, you know, have to be consistent and, you know, have strong conviction in our investment strategies. I think we've seen sponsors do a lot more pipe deals within this current crisis than they did back in the GFC. I see a lot more kind of growth deals getting done and growth funds being raised. And I think that's mainly down to the fact that a disruptor's ability to kind of shake out an incumbent within a given sector is huge right now because of the pandemic. And as a result of that, you know, we're seeing a lot more growth transactions, and growth transactions are typically easier to finance within this current environment, because we did see kind of lending activity and kind of the high yield debt, the CLO market really dry up during the quarter. And then also we've seen, you know, LPs were very much dealing with the denominator effects during the GFC. And, you know, when the pandemic first hit, you know, in March and kind of the UK, everyone did think, well, LPs, I'm sure, they thought the denominator effect was going to happen to them. But because of the unprecedented stimulus, there's been a sharp rebound in public equities, and LPs have kind of, some of them anyway, have continued to deploy and have kept pacing levels up, because it is impossible to time these PE markets. And, you know, 2020 vintages could prove to be some of the best performing vintages of recent years.
Talking about lessons learned, LPs they might have been hit by the denominator effect 10 years ago, but now they have changed a lot of their policies that say, well, we can wait a couple quarters to see how things settle out without having to sell everything at a fire sale. So I think they've learned a good lesson there, I think, in being a little patient and not letting market movements gyrate their portfolio too much.
Sure, absolutely.
So beyond lessons learned, or maybe because of lessons learned, what sort of disruption are you seeing in the European landscape in the private markets?
I think this disruption is going to come from mainly three areas within the kind of European private equity space. And it's those sponsors who I believe embrace these three areas are likely to be the winners in the next decade in the private markets. So firstly, I think sector specialization and sector specialists. I know there was definitely a trend towards that pre-COVID, but I think that has been accelerated by a number of years because of the pandemic. You know, sector specialists, whether they're coming at the fund level or the portfolio company level, you know, they bring, you know, kind of deep domain knowledge of a specific industry, and they have a wide network. We are seeing GPs increase value for portfolio companies via bolt-ons, via inorganic M&A, and these sector specialists will understand kind of what quality deal flow looks like. They also are going to assist sponsors in understanding, you know, the micro and kind of the macroeconomic drivers of a sector, and in understanding where the disruption is coming from in good and bad times. And they're going to drive value beyond the kind of typical financial engineering. So I think these sector specialists will help sponsors in rewriting the way companies present themselves to the market, because I think that's completely changed because of the pandemic. And then the second area of disruption I feel that's going to occur in this space is I think sponsors are going to have to reevaluate their value creation plans. You know, when they bought an asset pre-COVID-19, those 3 to 5 areas you thought you could add value to a portfolio company, do those still stand in this new normal? And you know, only sponsors could answer that question. So I think there's going to have to be a fundamental reevaluation of value creation plans, and that could be done alongside sector specialists. And then finally, I think sponsors are really going to have to embrace the kind of technological digitization revolution we're seeing across the world. You know, I definitely think the fundraising process is going to be a lot more remote than it was previously. Sponsors have seen, you know, we can have video calls via Zoom or Microsoft Teams, you know, with LPs, and you know, LPs are perfectly comfortable with doing that. You know, some LPs have even invested in first-time funds without meeting the GP face-to-face. And I think this would have been kind of unthinkable prior to COVID-19, but this has happened. So I think it's those sponsors who embrace technology and using technology for the entire investment value creation, from deal sourcing, due diligence, execution, monitoring portfolio companies and exiting them. I think those guys who kind of embrace the kind of AI, machine learning, analytics, etc., are going to be the ones who are going to be the winners. And in private equity, it's kind of all about speed to insight. So the faster kind of sponsors embrace technology in order for them to get quicker, better and more effective insights into a particular industry, the more productive they're likely to be.
Well, it's interesting. Some of the work that I've been doing has been related to sustainable investing and impact and ESG risk factors. And I've heard an argument that makes a lot of sense to me, that the companies that have been thinking about ESG risk factors, environmental, social governance, are going to be the ones thinking about sustainability and be more likely to be able to think on their feet and think of ways to survive this, as opposed to just cutting costs and hoping they can survive to the end. And I think this kind of echoes, or it can be married with the themes you're talking about, in terms of they're not as likely to embrace the change if they're just not used to thinking that way. And thinking sustainably allows you to sort of train to be ready for something like this.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Exit activity. What have you been hearing about deals abandoned or restructured in Europe? Unfortunately, that is a kind of exit.
Yeah, so I think it's pretty similar to the United States. So we've been seeing, you know, material adverse clause changes cited in deals in the second quarter. So some sponsors, you know, either paused on a transaction, either cancelled a transaction, or either, you know, asked the seller, can we renegotiate the terms of a transaction? We saw EQT, they scrapped their, I believe it was a $1.3 billion buyout of MetLife Care, and they cited COVID-19 concerns. I think we've also seen the rise of earnouts in private equity deal making. Mm-hmm. So sponsors are still willing to move forward with deals, but they said, you know, okay, can we save a portion of this kind of transaction fee, and can you know, we make sure that this portfolio company or this entity hits certain milestones before we pay out a full valuation of it? So yeah, that's what we've been kind of seeing in the European space.
That's interesting, because, you know, there's so much dry powder in the private equity landscape with so much money chasing deals, that they've still managed to find a way to come up with better deal terms, even in a very competitive environment, just by citing the crisis, which, you know, I still think there's a disconnect between the pain being felt on the ground and valuations, deals, stock markets, all that kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to see if 2020 really is a great performance, you know, if they've been continuing to do deals and this drags out longer than people expect. It could be interesting times for a while to come.
No, yeah, definitely. And to be honest, I don't think we've seen the pain yet of COVID-19. I think that's set to come once we see the government, the fiscal and monetary support wind down. I think that's when we're going to kind of see those unemployment figures, you know, increase, unfortunately. And that's when, you know, we're going to see kind of consumer demand reduce, and then, you know, private equity backed companies, you know, their cash flow profiles are likely to come under a lot more pressure. And I think that's when we're going to see the real pain, unfortunately. But right now, you know, I would say the global economy is on a life support machine from, you know, governments and central banks.
Yeah, for sure. I see you commented on defaults in the first half, but a default doesn't necessarily mean the end of an investment, just that a technical covenant may have tripped and conversations are now needed between the lender and borrower. Do you have any idea how worrisome some of the defaults have actually been?
Yeah, so in the first half in the European space, I believe the amount of defaults we saw was more than the full-year figures for 2018 and 2019 within Europe. But as you said, a default doesn't mean a company is not going to operate again. And we've seen a number of companies within the European space been saved or been bought out from administrators. For example, we saw Byron Burger. They were recently sold to Calverton UK after filing a notice to appoint administrators. We also saw the Casual Dining Group. They were bought out by administrators, which saved, you know, thousands of jobs and hundreds of restaurants. So I think only time will tell how severe these defaults are. But so far, we are seeing a number of companies being bought out from administrators. Unfortunately, we will see some portfolio companies never come back to life. And that's just, you know, the kind of negative effects of a recession and a pandemic. But we are seeing some being, you know, saved from administrators' hands. And we are seeing those restructuring private equity groups, you know, lean into markets and save these companies.
IPOs have rather unexpectedly come roaring back in the US while the pandemic rages on. Are there any hot areas you're seeing in Europe despite COVID?
So the IPO market, as I said, you know, the unprecedented monetary support and fiscal support has really, really, you know, driven the public equity markets. It seems that the public equity markets have wholeheartedly embraced all of this fiscal and monetary support we've seen. I do see in the US the IPO market is definitely picking up. I would say it's not as buoyant in Europe, but I believe it is on the gradual increase. We did see in the second quarter the largest European IPO since 2011, JDE peaked. They raised 2.3 billion euros at an approximate 15 billion euro pre-money valuation. And I would also say some other areas, I'll say SPACs, so special purpose acquisition companies, that's definitely a hot area at the moment. We're seeing more of them come up in Europe and the US, and that's an alternative to the traditional IPO
process. SPACs are not unique to the US. I was thinking they might just be a way around US regulations, but it sounds like it is also a tool that is being used across the pond.
Yes, there are definitely some European sponsors who are raising and you know, sponsoring SPACs and increasingly looking to use this as a tool to bring companies to the public markets.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much, Dom, for joining us for today's episode.
Thank you for having me. It's been a wonderful talking to you.
As always, for listeners looking for show notes and other relevant materials, such as our Q2 European PE breakdown, you can go to pitchbook.com/podcast. Please consider rating and reviewing the show to help others discover it. I'm Hillary Wick, and I thank you again for listening to this episode of PitchBook's Invisible Capital Podcast.